Today on the South Florida Roundup, many Florida Democrats used to be on the fence about the impeachment of President Donald Trump. That changed this week. Hello, I'm Christine DeMattei, filling in for Tom Hudson. As House Democrats push forward with a formal impeachment inquiry of President Trump, we'll be speaking with a Democratic congresswoman to get the latest from Capitol Hill, and also to the chairman of the Republican Party of Miami-Dade. We'll also be discussing what effect the impeachment probes could have on U.S. relations with Latin America and the Caribbean. Plus, why it's getting well-nigh impossible to find a reasonably priced rental apartment in South Florida. We talk to experts about possible solutions. All that and more coming up on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DeMattei, filling in for Tom Hudson. Until this week, most Florida Democrats were extremely circumspect about calling for the impeachment of President Donald Trump. For some, the release of the Mueller report on Russian interference in the 2016 election and accusations that Trump obstructed justice in that investigation were more than enough. Still, that word impeachment was largely avoided by some Florida Democrats. Until, of course, this week. Allegations that Trump pressured the president of Ukraine to open up a corruption investigation of former Vice President Joe Biden, well, for many Florida Democrats, that was the breaking strain. Democrats and Republicans nationwide are now making their cases for and against impeachment. Earlier today, we interviewed South Florida Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Now, when you heard that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi would be announcing the launch of the impeachment inquiry, what were you doing at the time?
Well, we were in an emergency caucus meeting, and earlier in the afternoon, I released my own statement that I decided it was imperative that we advance an impeachment inquiry against the president because, I mean, we have evidence of a presidential shakedown and a cover-up that puts our national security and elections under threat. When you look at the transcript of the phone call with President Zelensky in Ukraine, and then you add the whistleblower report, which gives a more fulsome description of the kind of cover-up activity that's taken place, the undue pressure that the president put on the president of a foreign country, essentially threatening to withhold funding that they vitally need in order to advance his political goals and go after his main political opponent, that is about as close to something that deserves an impeachment process to begin as I could find. And I held off and wanted to make sure that the investigations and the reviews were appropriate. But the president is implicated here dead to rights himself. And it's just unacceptable and I think likely rises to a high crime and misdemeanor.
Now, there are several news outlets that have pointed out that the decision of moderate Democrats in Florida to get behind the impeachment inquiry seemed to have been a turning point this week for most other Democrats in the state. How true would you say that is?
I think each member of Congress has to come to our own individual decision. You really can't make a decision on something as significant as whether or not to go through an impeachment inquiry of the president based on what another member has decided. What was critical for me was that the president engaged in what I am confident is unlawful conduct to shake down, hold over the head of a president of a foreign country vital assistance that Ukraine needs, particularly to keep Russia at bay, which directly involves our national security interests, all in the name of trying to go after one of his main political rivals in the presidential election, is an abuse of power for personal gain. And then White House lawyers tried to hide it, putting the transcript of that call and the summary of that call in a code-worded file that would be less likely to be seen. It's just cover-up on top of abuse of power. And so for me, once you had conduct that directly implicated the president, where he appears to have been committing high crimes and misdemeanors, which is the definition of impeachable offenses, for me, that took this in an entirely different direction.
Without a doubt, this has been a momentous week in American politics. Congresswoman, I'm curious to know what, if anything, you've been hearing from your constituents right here in South Florida, the voters, our people here. What have they been telling you during this week?
Not just this week, but prior to this week.
Right.
I have had a steady stream of my constituents who really firmly believe that an impeachment inquiry was essential, that the president has repeatedly engaged in abuse of power, has engaged in using and manipulating the tools of power and the White House to his own personal gain and advantage. And as I said, of course, how my constituents feel weighs heavily on me, but I wanted to, I wanted to make sure that the investigations, and I sit on the House Oversight Committee. So we're, we're one of the six committees that are reviewing the president's conduct and investigating some of the disturbing allegations against him. And so I wanted to make sure that those had some time to advance. But this was conduct of an urgent nature. You have a whistleblower who had their accusation certified by the Office of Inspector General as being serious and credible, which under the statute required it to be submitted by the Director of National Intelligence to the Congress. And initially, the White House was refusing to do that. That's unacceptable to begin with. Then when they finally, realizing that the impeachment process was going to begin, they did ultimately release the transcript of the call and or a summary of the transcript of the call and the whistleblower report, and both were damning. Separately from the whistleblower report, you have only to look at the conversation between President Trump and President Zelensky to see that it was very clear that President Trump was attempting to pressure President Zelensky into opening an investigation and going after Vice President Biden and his son.
And for Democrats, for most Democrats, that was just simply a bridge too far.
No, the bridge too far was withholding previously appropriated vital foreign aid for Ukraine. And I sit on the Appropriations Committee, and so I'm deeply involved in the appropriations decisions, withholding funds that had been certified by the Pentagon to be appropriate to allocate to Ukraine in the name of pressuring a foreign president to do his political bidding was a bridge too far.
On the subject of funds, we've received news this morning that the Republican Party of Florida sent out a fundraising email blast with a message from Governor Ron DeSantis asking for donations to what he calls a, quote, presidential protection fund, responding to the impeachment inquiry. Can you comment on that?
It's really outrageous that we don't have Republicans that care more about the Constitution and more about making sure that we don't have a president who's run amok, who is violating the law by withholding appropriated funds to assist a foreign country that is trying to keep one of our most significant enemies, Russia, at bay, and doing so in the name of advancing his political interests. That's unpatriotic. It's unacceptable. And so anything other than commentary from Republicans that an impeachment inquiry is necessary, we need to look at all the facts, and an objective decision reached by them once that happens is, to me, that means that they're willing to aid and abet the president's conduct and look the other way. But, it's typical of the Republicans' actions recently from top to bottom. They care more about holding on to their own power than they do about doing the right thing.
Congresswoman, thank you so much for this time.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was South Florida Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz speaking to us earlier from Washington, D.C. And in the studio with us now is the chairman of the Republican Party of Miami-Dade, Nelson Diaz. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Surely. Nelson, I'm going to ask you the same thing that I asked Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz at the start. When you heard that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi would be announcing the launch of this impeachment inquiry, what went through your mind?
Well, it's kind of curious because I think she owes it to the American people to have a vote on whether to proceed with impeachment hearings. To this date, there has been no vote in the Congress, only talk of it. And I understand why she's trying to protect some vulnerable Democrats in Republican seats, and she doesn't want to put them on the board in voting for it or not. But it's clear that, you know, Speaker Pelosi is really Speaker in name only, and that in all reality, the Speaker of the House is a freshman congresswoman from New York who's really driving the train, driving the agenda for an impeachment proceeding that has zero chance of passing in the Senate. That's really nothing more than a political stunt by the Democratic Party to rile up their base. And I understand what they're trying to do, and I think it's wrong. I think they're wasting taxpayer dollars or wasting time on an issue that is not going to happen.
Well, before this week's events, Republicans and Democrats were already gearing up for a fierce and expensive fight for the presidency in 2020. Now, I'm not asking you to give away your entire strategy here on live radio, but all this impeachment talk, it is damaging. It is damaging. So how does this affect your approach as a strategist?
Well, it's damaging because I think the media in this country has determined that the president is guilty of something, when in reality, this was a whistleblower complaint filed by someone with no firsthand knowledge of the conversation. And we don't know everything he said here is true. I understand the president, we release the transcripts and we see what's in the transcripts. The president of Ukraine said he did not feel any sort of pressure to abide by what the president asked or mentioned. And I think that if this was a Democratic president making the same request, the media would have hailed that Democratic president as a hero for rooting out corruption. I think the real cover up here is the Democratic Party trying to cover up for Vice President Joe Biden asking or in demanding that the Ukrainian president fire the corruption investigator in Ukraine that was investigating his son, who had a very lucrative contract with an oil and gas company in Ukraine. And I think the Democrats are trying to cover that up and distract from the real subject here, that the vice president, the former vice president, even publicly admitted how proud he was that he got the government of Ukraine to fire this prosecutor who was investigating his son and the company that his son worked for. I think that's a scandal, and I think that's what's being covered up.
Well, a second ago you mentioned the media, I am a member of that club. Do you feel that there is anyone among us who has been fair? You feel that manifestly we've all of us been unfair to this president?
I wouldn't say everyone has been unfair to this president, but I would say, I mean, I think the last study I saw said that 95% of the news on the president of the United States was negative and attack, and it was all attack. And so I'm not saying you in particular.
Oh, no, that I know.
But generally speaking, I think the media is certainly taken by the left. I think most of the media in this country leans very far left and leans very heavily against this president.
Okay. I'm just right off the cuff here. A comment, as long as we're talking about the media. The president has been quoted as calling us enemies of the people. Where do you stand on that?
I wouldn't say that the media is the enemy of the people. I think the media needs to come back to a time when the media was fair, truly fair and balanced, and reported facts and not opinion. I mean, we see Don Lemon on CNN comparing the president to Hitler. I mean, this is just crazy stuff, right? I think we need to get back to a time when the media, all of the media, was truly just the facts and just reporting the facts as they occur and not with their own personal slant.
We all know that swing voters, undecided voters, and independents can turn the tide of any election. Nelson, there are many such voters in South Florida who on Election Day 2016 might not have thought that candidate Trump was the greatest statesman in the world, but who liked his reformist agenda, and they wanted a change. They simply wanted a change. Now, even if Trump is not removed from office, why should the same people give their votes to him again in 2020?
I think this president, unlike so many in the past, has really kept his promises. He said, this is who I am. I'm not going to change when I become president. And I don't think anybody can argue that he's changed. And he said, this is what I'm going to do. And he has at least attempted to do almost everything that he said he's going to do. Now, he's hit some roadblocks, namely in the name of Congress. But he has done what he said he was going to do. And we don't get that very often in presidents. I mean, he moved the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem when almost every president before him said he would never do it. He said he would reform the economy, provide tax cuts, and deregulate certain overregulations that had occurred in the past. And he's done all of that. He promised to name some conservative Supreme Court justices and judges to our court system. And he's done that. And I think, he's done a good job. The economy is doing well. Things are going well. I think he deserves a second term, and I think voters will see through all of this, all of the noise that the Democrats are doing with the impeachment stuff.
Nelson, be honest with me now. I just asked Debbie Wasserman Schultz what she's been hearing from her constituents about all of this. What have you been hearing from Republicans in South Florida who are starting to get nervous about this? All this impeachment talk, like I said, is damaging. It's only natural that Republicans and, yes, independent and undecided voters are going to get nervous about it, too. What have you been hearing?
Well, the last time there was an impeachment proceeding, it was done by us, the Republicans, and it didn't go well for us in the next election. I've not heard a lot of people being nervous about not winning the next election, not doing well in the next election because of the impeachment proceeding. On the contrary, I've heard a lot of people very upset that they're actually going forward with this. And I've actually heard from some NPAs, family members and friends, who are just tired of the investigations, tired of the attacks, and they just want Congress to get to work, work on policy, work on the budget, come together, sit at the same table with Republicans and get to work on the work that the people elected them to do.
Very quickly, because we're running out of time, I wanted to talk a second about this Presidential Protection Fund. Governor DeSantis, on behalf of the Republican Party of Florida, is calling for donations for it. If a voter gives to this fund, where does that money go?
Well, I think you have to ask Governor DeSantis about exactly where that money goes, but I would imagine it goes to a fund that will help the president be reelected.
And we surely will be asking him. We've been speaking with Nelson Diaz, chairman of the Republican Party of Miami-Dade. Nelson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, what kind of signal does the U.S. impeachment inquiry send to other countries in the Western Hemisphere? That's just ahead right here on the South Florida Roundup. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte. The start of impeachment talks in Washington could have far-reaching implications beyond the United States. It matters to all the Americas as well. WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett makes the case in his latest commentary that an impeachment probe sends a clear message about the United States standard for the rule of law. I spoke with Tim about this earlier. Tim, while most of America has been riveted by events in Washington, there's also been plenty of drama in other parts of the Western Hemisphere this week. What has been going on in the Americas?
Well, a lot, actually. And one of the big things is that we're seeing sort of an unprecedented movement by a lot of Latin American and Caribbean countries to lean on a regional neighbor, meaning Venezuela. They're sort of banding together with the United States to invoke this 1947 treaty called the Rio Treaty to side against Venezuela and accuse it of a lot of nefarious activities like getting involved with Colombian guerrillas to pursue drug trafficking, things of that nature. And as I said, it was sort of unprecedented. And then you go down to sort of the ridiculous in this hemisphere. On Monday, we had a federal senator in Haiti, fire repeatedly his gun outside the legislature, outside the parliament building in Port-au-Prince, and he ended up wounding two people, including an AP photographer. And so we were sort of reminded, you know, while we're so glued to this drama here in the United States about whether or not our president violated the rule of law here, we were sort of reminded of the chronic lack of rule of law that Latin Americans often have to deal with.
Tim, before we get to the impeachment inquiry in Washington, D.C., the title of your piece this week is Trump Trap. Don't expect rule of law from Americas if we can't expect it from America. So help us out here. Define rule of law for us.
it's what we have been living with for more than two centuries, or what we in America like to think we've been living with for two centuries. The fact that our judicial institutions, our government institutions, work according to the rules, according to the Constitution. And unfortunately, in Latin America and the Caribbean, that has not been the case for the past two centuries. They have been struggling with trying to create rule of law and the kind of institutions that respect rule of law and constitutionality. And I think that's one of the sort of contrasts that I'm looking at in that article this week.
Now, getting to the impeachment discussions, much of the outrage about President Trump's phone call to the president of Ukraine was over the suggestion that there was at least implicitly some sort of quid pro quo. In that case, it was, you launch an investigation into my political opponent, Joe Biden, and I'll give you military aid money. Now, in your commentary this week, you describe Trump's foreign policy style with certain Central American leaders as, quote, extortionist. What did you mean by that?
Well, it does very much resemble that phone call that he made with the president of Ukraine very much resembles the kind of dealings that we've seen President Trump make with Central American leaders, such as President Jimmy Morales in Guatemala and President Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras. Both of those presidents are under investigation or are accused of crimes in their countries. Jimmy Morales' case, it's illicit campaign financing. In Honduras, it's even worse. The president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, is accused of having ties to the country's drug traffickers. And there's this undercurrent then of President Trump sort of pressuring them to accept this agreement that he wanted them to make, to essentially make their country's holding pens for Central American and other migrants who want to go up to the United States border to seek asylum. And there's a real troubling issue here about whether they made those agreements with President Trump in order for the United States to sort of look the other way concerning their own allegedly corrupt practices. And President Trump has also, you know, told them that has threatened to withhold aid from those Central American countries if they don't start doing more to keep migrants from moving north.
Well, Tim, I'm wondering why these instances that you just spoke about are not exciting as much comment as, I don't know, the Mueller investigation or now this new problem with Ukraine.
Because, as I say in the commentary, it's just part and parcel of what we've come to expect from the developing world, quote unquote, what we've come to expect from Latin America and the Caribbean. We don't expect there to be the kind of rule of law practiced by the leaders in those countries that we expect from our leaders. And the point of my article was that it's important to at least investigate this concern about the call that President Trump made to the Ukraine, because it shows the rest of the hemisphere that we're still serious about rule of law in our own country. And that matters a lot, because the United States has always been, or should be, the rule of law model for the rest of a hemisphere that hasn't enjoyed a tradition of rule of law for the past two centuries. So as the headline in my article points out, you know, we can't really expect rule of law to start developing and flourishing in the rest of the hemisphere if we don't show it here ourselves in America.
Now, this phone call with the president of Ukraine has raised questions about, Tim, the kind of freedom that an American president has when it comes to dealing with other foreign leaders directly. There have been factions cautioning against impeachment on the grounds that it will weaken the chief executive's ability to do that, to communicate freely with foreign leaders. Do you foresee that happening?
I really don't, because if the president of the United States is holding conversations with leaders of other nations that don't involve this kind of quid pro quo, this sort of unconstitutional request on the part of a president to get another country to help him out with his own personal political endeavors, meaning a presidential campaign, which is what this whistleblower is alleging that President Trump did. I think as long as presidents aren't, you know, stepping over that line, there shouldn't be any reason for them to worry about this.
Now, the United States for many years now has been dealing with an influx of immigrants from troubled Central American countries. How can we have meaningful immigration reform at the same time that we are dealing with this impeachment inquiry?
Well, I think in order for us to have immigration reform, we have to show the rest of the hemisphere, Latin America and the Caribbean, that we are serious about not dealing with them in the way that we have seen President Trump deal, for example, with Guatemala and Honduras in the ways that I was just describing. I think we can start to work with the rest of the hemisphere on issues like immigration much more effectively if we show them that we're dealing with them more honestly than I think a lot of people have said President Trump is dealing with the leaders of Central American countries.
This week, Reuters is reporting that Latin American stocks slipped in the midst of all the impeachment talks. Tim, how does political uncertainty in Washington, D.C. affect emerging markets in Latin America and the Caribbean?
Well, quite a bit, because Latin America is so tied to the United States in terms of trade, but also in terms of diplomacy. For example, the case that I was talking about at the outset of our conversation here about Venezuela. So politically and economically, yes, Latin America, what happens in the United States when we do have this kind of political trauma and drama, it does create a lot of uncertainty in the rest of the hemisphere. So it doesn't surprise me that we saw that kind of market reaction in Latin America. And there is going to be a lot of anxiety there about this.
Let's talk a little more about Venezuela. A monstrous humanitarian crisis happening there. Just this week, the Trump administration repledged its support for Venezuela and mapped out a plan for what happens if the regime of Nicolas Maduro finally collapses. Now, part of that is an additional $100 million of humanitarian aid.
Right.
And that brings the total commitment to about $568 million. Now, in the event that Trump is impeached, and it's a long shot, considering a Republican-controlled
sure.
Senate
mm-hmm.
removed from office.
Right.
How easy is it going to be for the United States to keep those promises to Venezuela?
Oh, I think it will be easy, because I don't think President Trump is the only leader in Washington who agrees that we have to try to influence regime change in Venezuela. I think whether you're Democrat or Republican, and we've seen that, for example, with the Democrats here in the South Florida Congressional Caucus, whether you're liberal, conservative, Democrat, or Republican, there is a consensus in the United States right now that there has to be regime change in Venezuela, that this socialist, authoritarian socialist regime down there has essentially destroyed the nation, both economically and in terms of its democracy. And so whether or not President Trump is sitting in the White House, I think you'll see that consensus remain in Washington.
Tim, I'm sure throughout this week you've been hearing from reporters in other countries and policy experts from the myriad countries in the Americas that you cover, the ones that are your beat, essentially. What have they been asking you? What is their top concern about what is going on in Washington, D.C. right now?
I think they are most interested in essentially the theme that I laid out in my commentary this week. Like me, they're not judging, they're not making a judgment on whether or not President Trump should be impeached, but they do want to see some indication that there is still that commitment to rule of law. As I say in the commentary, they do want to at least be reassured that in the United States, we still pull presidents over when they run constitutional red lights. And as I said, whether or not President Trump is impeached, I think a lot of my colleagues have been expressing that this is sort of a test to see if the United States is still committed to that kind of rule of law procedure that the rest of the hemisphere has sort of always looked to as a model.
We've been talking to WLRN America's editor Tim Padgett. On our website, WLRN.org, you can find Tim's commentary about what kind of signal the impeachment inquiry in Washington, D.C. is sending to other countries. And you can hear WLRN's Latin America report every Tuesday. Right now, we need to take a break, but coming up in just a moment, if you feel that you're working just to keep the roof over your head, we'd like to hear from you during our next segment. We'll be talking about how finding an affordable rental apartment in South Florida is fast becoming the impossible dream. If you'd like to join that conversation, please keep our call-in number handy. It's 1-800-743-WLRN. Once again, that's 800-743-9576. We'll be right back. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Christine DiMatte. To paraphrase activist and perennial candidate Jimmy McMillan, the rent is too darned high. That's the verdict for most renters in South Florida and the conclusion of numerous recent housing studies showing that a majority of renters in our region are cost burdened. That means they're paying more than one-third of their income on housing alone. Now, the quest to find an affordable apartment is leading to desperation among many would-be renters, and that in turn is leading to abuse. The Miami Herald recently reported that condo associations are charging renters and buyers exorbitant application and move-in fees, even though Florida law prohibits that. Now, before we introduce our guests for this segment, we want to remind our listeners that we really want to hear from you about this, especially if you're an apartment renter or would-be renter. You can ask our panel a question and tell us your story. What kind of experience did you have finding an apartment here in South Florida? Are you still looking? What has it been like for you? Call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. And you can always send us a text to 786-786-7636. Please give your first name and where you're from in South Florida. That number again to text only is 786-786-7636. And we already heard from a number of our listeners throughout the past couple of weeks via social media on this. One on Twitter, one listener, quote, said, "Fought a fraudulent false eviction and got them to pay us a settlement. Then after months of looking, I lucked into a place we found on Craigslist just weeks before our move-out date. Raul also via Twitter wrote us to say, quote, "Not looking anymore. Going to leave town and hopefully never come back." Wow. So why are rents so high in South Florida, and what can be done to solve this problem? Here in the studio to help us answer those questions is Steve Patterson. He's president and chief executive officer of Related Development for the Related Group here in South Florida. He is responsible for all of the company's multifamily rental and mixed-use development activities. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
And also here in the studio is Brian Bandel. He covers real estate for the South Florida Business Journal. Brian, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And from the Miami Herald newsroom, we have Miami Herald real estate reporter Renee Rodriguez. Renee, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Christine.
So let me begin with an autobiographical note that I think sort of illustrates what kind of changes we've seen in the rental market over the last few decades. I moved from New York to South Florida in 1995, and almost immediately, without much effort, scored this beautiful little studio apartment in Fort Lauderdale on A1A, right across the street from the beach. $580 a month. I couldn't believe my luck. Standard rental agreement, security deposit, no ridiculous fees. Now, if I tried to find the same deal today, no way. So, Brian, let me begin with you. We're not talking ancient history here. What has changed between 1995 and now?
There are two main reasons rental prices are much higher, especially in relation to what people earn. One is the law of supply and demand. The population has been growing a lot here, and the number of new rentals developed has not kept pace with that. So there's a relatively small amount of rentals that are vacant. So you have a lot of people fighting for a limited supply. The second reason is one of the best ways to make money is to buy an old rental complex, fix it up a little, put in new carpet, and then raise the rent a lot. That's a pretty common strategy, and so the more that happens, the more people say, well, it's easy to buy, fix, and raise the prices, the more they can charge people.
I just heard an there. Renee, was that you?
Yes, and I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Do you agree essentially with what Brian just said?
Absolutely, and another thing compounding the problem is because home prices have gotten so high, there's an entire generation of would-be first-time home buyers who simply cannot afford to buy a home just from the down payment alone. And so they're also entering the rental market, which exacerbates the shortage of affordably priced rentals.
Steve Patterson, tell us about some ways that rental prices are determined for a particular neighborhood. Does it depend upon the median price of homes in the area? What goes on there?
I think Brian wrapped it up pretty succinctly. It's basically this law of supply and demand, and when we build too much product, the rents come down, and when we don't build enough, they go up.
Renee, you were part of the Miami Herald reporting team that brought us the investigative series titled Priced Out of Paradise. How are South Florida families coping with the affordability crisis?
you know, there's no one way for them to be coping. People seem to do it on a variety of different levels. But one really interesting statistic that we included in that series is, according to the U.S. Census, from July 2017 to July 2018, South Florida lost 58,000 American U.S. residents. Okay, only New York, L.A., and Chicago lost more. We also gained 93,000 new immigrants, which puts us second only to New York City. So what you're seeing is a lot of people who are from here or lived here are being forced to move out simply because they literally cannot afford to stay here.
Okay, and the people who have been living here for a long time, who you just spoke about, when you say they're forced out, where are they going to?
They're going to places like Orlando, Port St. Lucie, and also they're moving to areas that are so small that they're not even designated metro areas. So they're either moving northward in the state where things are slightly more affordable, or they're just moving to really small rural areas.
Yeah, and keep in mind the salaries, like in Orlando and other parts of the state, they're not that different than South Florida, but the housing prices are a lot less.
So I'm gonna step in here and I'm gonna make a contrarian argument, and that is it's not necessarily just that the rents are so darn high; it is because the incomes are too darn low. And there's something called the Miami discount factor, and what that is it's a combination of two things. People that live in Miami are willing to settle for less income, because Florida is the least taxed state in the country, number one in terms of tax on individuals, and that's from all kinds of things, from income tax to license plate charges. The second is because of the desirability of Miami. People want to live here, and they're willing to work for less to live in this city. So when you look at those factors, housing here is not necessarily expensive. Miami's barely in the top 20 in the country. The fact of the matter is that our incomes are lower than the national average, and people are feeling the pain.
When compared to the other places nationwide, I mean, where does South Florida stand with rents in terms of compared to the national average?
I mean, our rents are obviously higher than average, but we're not in the top tier. We're not San Francisco or Boston or New York, but we don't have salaries like that. We don't have a Silicon Valley, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have a Wall Street. So we don't have those types of gigantic salaries.
But do you see it trending that way?
I don't know if we'll get that high in all of South Florida. I mean, there are obviously very pockets that are expensive, you know, that like on South Beach in Brickell, but still not Manhattan expensive. But I think the difference is we don't have those kind of salaries, and you're seeing the average just get a lot higher.
That's right. And and Steve is absolutely right. It's not that our prices are higher. It's that our wages are stagnant. So it's not that we're the most expensive city, but we are the third least affordable city in the country when it comes to income versus housing costs. And in terms of level of income inequality, which means the lowest wage earners and the highest wage earners, we're second only to New York City.
And once again, we're reaching out to our listeners. We'd like to hear from you during this segment. Please call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. And on the line, we're going to hear from Peter from Miami Gardens. He's got a question or comment. Peter, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. I've been renting for probably about 20 years now, in and out of different apartments. And I've noticed a steady trend starting in West Palm Beach when I first lived there about 15 years ago. They started implementing these laws against commercial vehicles and banning them on property. And it used to cost me hundreds. And this would often happen when companies would take over property. And it just seems like there's no regulation for these commercial vehicles to be on these properties, at least at the bare minimum, designate a parking area for these commercial vehicles.
Well, Peter, I think you're talking about an entirely different topic here. You say you've been in and out of apartments for 20 years, and we're talking specifically about the high price of rentals in South Florida. So how does commercial vehicles affect that?
Well, you know, when I'm trying to make a living and pay the rent, you guys are forcing me not to move out of nice areas that I would normally be able to afford. But now I have to keep moving further down south or up north away from where I work. And it's just every year that you rent, what happens is the next year they offer you a re-sign and you have to pay another $100 on top of what you were paying.
Yeah, I think the difficulty with renting versus owning is when you're renting, you can't live by your own rules. You have to live by the rules of the complex.
Right.
That's the challenge.
Right. And I was just going to say the same thing. And we're going to be covering those fees that Peter just spoke about in a second, or similar fees like that, because unfortunately that's what you find in a lot of these apartment buildings or condos. You know, the move-in fees that one of those Twitter listeners just wrote about. So
Peter did make a good point that does have something to do with what's happening and what's going to happen in the future. He's going to have, in 5 years, no problem finding a place to park his commercial vehicle, because fewer and fewer people are going to be driving cars. So that's something that we really feel needs to happen. Right now, the city of Miami, people pay about 33-35% of their wages for rent. They pay about 15% of their wages for transportation. And one of the things that's going to have to evolve is people are going to have to spend less and less on transportation. It means Miami-Dade has to focus on public transportation that's free or cost-effective. And it also means that people are going to have to give up a car. And that's just a trend that is inevitable, and it's going to happen. And the good news is that we'll build less parking spaces for less cars. People will have more disposable income for rent, and we'll save some money on parking spaces.
And hopefully within this conversation, we can discuss the transit-oriented community. I'm hoping we can get to that. Right now, Rene Rodriguez, there's something relatively new on the block, so to speak. It's the concept of co-living. What is that? And give us a couple of examples. Can we find some examples of that already in South Florida?
Yeah, sure. So co-living is a fancy way of saying living with roommates. The difference is that instead of applying for an apartment when you're going to go rent, you apply for a specific bedroom. And depending on the size of the unit, you pay accordingly. So you could rent a bedroom in a two-bedroom unit, or you could rent in a three-bedroom unit. There's one building in downtown Miami that's been using the concept, X Miami, which is by PMG Groups. And about 15 of the floors in that building are co-living. They're breaking ground on a new building at 400 Biscayne. That's also going to use the same concept. And they're completing one in Las Olas early next year. That's also going to use the same concept. And so the idea is communal living. So the idea is you can live in the heart of downtown Miami. You can live inside this beautifully appointed building with crazy amenities.
But you have to share something.
You have to share the common space. Each bedroom has its own bathroom, right? So you do have some sense of privacy. And it's very appealing for young professionals. It's very appealing for people who live very social, interactive lifestyles.
What do the rents look like in the ones that we've seen so far?
Well, the rents aren't cheap. I mean,
there we go again.
Yes, at X Miami, rents range from about $1,500 for a studio to as much as $1,900 for a bedroom and a bathroom inside a three bedroom unit. But don't forget that the building, it has crazy amenities. So it's very appealing to a very specific segment of the population, which is a certain age demographic, doesn't necessarily have familial responsibilities, has a good paying job, and has the flexibility and ability to live in downtown Miami.
And you have to be very social, too. They're not mind someone in your kitchen and hanging out in a lounge with somebody. You know, you have to be around people downstairs. So it's not for isolationists.
No.
It kind of sounds like a college dormitory living to me. I don't know.
It is. But it's proven very successful in Europe. And that's why you're seeing it grow more and more. Wynwood now has two co-living buildings, one by a British company called The Collective. And they have these co-living units all around the world, and you will read reviews online of people who really like them and people who, as you said, compare them to just fancy college dorms.
And once again, we'd really like to hear from listeners about all this. If you have an apartment rental search horror story, and, you know, we don't want to be entirely grim here. If you've got an apartment search success story, we want to hear from you as well. Please call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. And right now on the phone, we're going to go to Debbie from Little Havana. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing today, guys?
Good.
Fantastic. I'm going to give a perspective of a multifamily term building owner. We've been owners for 40 years now. My parents started in the 70s, early 70s in Miami. And we are a very hands-on, selfless, sacrificial family that really works hard to keep our tenants happy. So I need to tell you a little bit of insight from our side why prices are what they are. Well, there's various reasons that you haven't discussed. Number one, real estate taxes are extremely expensive in Miami, city of Miami, North Miami Beach. I deal with both. Number two, property insurance, liability insurance prices are extremely high. And you want to make sure you keep your, you know, property safe and tenant safe, but you need to do the right thing, right? So, number three, if you want to be a responsible owner, you take care, of course, of repairs and anything that needs to be done, which my family, we've always been, you know, very hands-on. So, we know exactly what we do with property, right? Number four.
Okay, I think Debbie, we have to keep it at number four, okay?
Okay.
Number four, and that's four. It, because we got to go.
Well, let me tell you, super important that you need to know. City of Miami, whenever you do 40-year recertification and 10-year recertification, for example, I just had an 8-unit that I had to do that for. We had a building that had perfect electricity, never any problem. If the city of Miami and any municipality tells you that you need to upgrade and put in a whole new electrical system, whatever they ask you for, you need to do it.
Okay.
Otherwise, you will not be recertified.
Okay.
I spent $100,000 on electrical upgrades that I really did not have to
Okay,
do.
Debbie, I think we get it. I think we get it. Okay, yeah, what we very, very, you know, this is something that we very, very seldom hear. We very seldom hear, you know, things from the landlord's point of view. Debbie makes a very, very good point. Steve, you were nodding as she was speaking.
Well, she does. Those are all things that factor into the cost to rent or for the landlord to rent. And I think something that is probably exacerbating the problem right now is construction costs have obviously gone up significantly. In fact, since the bottom of the recession, which was somewhere between 8-10 years ago, we've had a 50% increase in construction costs. That drives the rents directly. There's no way to get around it. Now, what we're trying to do is build smaller. But the reality is the rents have actually gone up 50% since that trough as well. So even though Miami grows about 2 or 3% a year on average, this last 7 years has been a heck of a run-up because we were recovering from an extremely low.
Now, Steve, you hold degrees in engineering technology and construction management, and that means that you not only know about the profitability of multifamily buildings, but how they should be built. So what are developers doing to satisfy this demand? I mean, what is the best answer that you've seen so far?
Well, the simplest is obviously smaller. Spaces are going to have to get smaller. Less square footage should equate to lower overall rent.
Like the micro apartments?
Like micro units, yeah. We're building micro units in Wynwood, and we'll also be doing co-living. Co-living is a good way to bring that housing cost number down as well. Affordable housing, you simply can't build new product and deliver it at an affordable rate. You have to have subsidy. So it's important that we keep the governments engaged and they're providing subsidies to us so that we can deliver to that 60% or 80% of average median incomes.
And the state of Florida constantly has been keeping us short on the subsidies. They're not providing the full amount in the Sadowski fund that they could be. And a lot of times the subsidies aren't going only to South Florida and Tampa, where places that are expensive. Some of them are going to rural Florida where things aren't exactly expensive, but, you know, because they're legislators from rural Florida, they want affordable housing projects there, too.
That's right. And sometimes the Sadowski Fund gets rated also for things like hurricane repairs. So after Hurricane Michael's hit Panama City, a lot of the Sadowski Fund was diverted to repairs there. But that's not what that fund is intended for. That fund is intended specifically for affordable housing, but it gets put into this kind of slush fund.
And we're going to take another call right now. We've got on the line George from Fort Lauderdale. Welcome, George. You're on the air.
Hello. I noticed that, well, I heard this once on NPR a couple of weeks ago. I'm a constant listener. And your guest mentioning about supply and demand, these immutable laws. Well, there's another law of economics called a price inflation. So now the real reason they talked about how my South Floridians are paid lower taxes on license plates and everything. Well, the reason that the prices are going up on rentals and ownership is because there's too much money chasing properties, and that's coming from international money. Miami is an internationally known city, and everybody wants to live here.
And everyone wants to invest here, too, and that is part of it. There are a lot of people from overseas who view South Florida as a stable investment, and so they'll buy a property here for a good price, and they'll raise rents to try and justify their price. Yeah, that's, and sometimes the people paying those rents aren't necessarily local people. They might be people from overseas who can afford that rent, but they don't necessarily work here or live here all the time.
That's right. We've kind of become a victim of our own success in that way. According to Miami Association of Realtors, a third of all residential home sales in Miami are to foreign buyers. Think about that. It's a third. And that's because people want to come here and live here. What's not being addressed is what happens to the locals.
I will say this about the foreign buyers so they don't get all of the bad rap. They are typically buying as investments and not necessarily to occupy the units. And when they do that, they usually rent those apartments at numbers that are well below returns that others would be asking for.
That's right. Roughly about 45% of residential properties in Miami-Dade County do not have a homestead exemption, which means, and that's according to the Property Appraisers Office, which means, as Steve said, that they're bought as investments and put on the rental market.
Our guests today were Steve Patterson, President and Chief Executive Officer of Related Development for the Related Group, Brian Bandel, he covers real estate for the South Florida Business Journal, and Miami Herald real estate reporter Rene Rodriguez. He's part of the reporting team that worked on the series titled Priced Out of Paradise. It examines how Miami-Dade became the most expensive metro area in the United States for renters and one of the costliest for home buyers. That series explains why that's so, what it means for the region and its residents. That's all the time that we have left for today. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. The show's technical supervisor is Richard Ives. I'm Christine DiMatte, filling in for Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.